started, if that's okay. So I'm Jeremiah Gibson. I live in Quincy, Massachusetts. This is a suburb of Boston. I work at a place called the South Shore Sexual Health Center. I have, for those of you on the podcast, I have a bunch of letters after my name that make me sound way more official than I actually am. The LMFT is Licensed Marriage and Family Therapist, and then the CST is a Certified Sex Therapist. So those are kind of my jams. I do a lot of, most of my work is with couples therapy and working with sexuality. And obviously, growing up in the Church of Christ, there's an obvious intersection between sexuality and religion, and working with folks and caring for folks and with folks who grew up in religious contexts. So this is a big interest of mine. I wanted to start with some art. I'm told that Sarah didn't do this last night, but I wanted to take a look at some depictions of the scenes of David and Bathsheba from throughout the centuries. When Joella reached out to me to with the topic for the year, talking about David, saying, hey, do you want to speak again? And I said, well, obviously I'm going in the direction of doing something with David and Bathsheba. So, I don't want to, Sarah did some amazing work with this text last night. I don't want to do too much with the text itself, but let's take a look at some pictures and some artwork. This is from the artist Louis-Jean François Lajeunesse. I don't know. If you speak French, I apologize. So this is, obviously, this is Bathsheba. This is David here, kind of peeping in the corner here with the bridge. This is from the French Rococo artist Jean-Léon Gérôme. You know, same kinds of themes, although this looks an awful lot like southern Spain and not anywhere in Israel. Here's David again looking from the bridge. No artwork from the 20th century, but there was the movie David and Bathsheba from 1951. Gregory Peck, Susan Hayward. Susan Hayward plays Bathsheba as this femme fatale kind of character. Yeah, so when we look at how artists have portrayed, and particularly European artists have portrayed the David and Bathsheba scene, when we look through these paintings, you know, what stands out? What are some themes that we notice?
Well, she seems quite what, in charge or seductive.
Uh-huh, right.
Yeah, seductive probably, but also that she is purposeful maybe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which, as Sarah explained last night, is very opposite from what actually happened in what she referred to as king culture, where men use sexual relationships to enhance their power and as a form of control, not just over women, but over the larger nation. Other thoughts?
Do we know that she had maids and, you know, everyone around her would be helping her with her
right.
bath?
So particularly in these first two paintings, there's this suggestion of class, right. that Bathsheba comes from, like, this high-class family, that she has servants, she has foot soldiers, she has folks that help her get dressed, those types of things. When in actuality, it's very, very probable that that Bathsheba was in a lower class context, definitely compared to where King David was, the prophet. So.
The placement of David is interesting in those, especially in the art. Mm-hmm. Knowing the context, you can figure out who it is, but
sure.
otherwise, he's barely there. Mm-hmm. You know, not just lurking, although he's obviously doing that, he's barely there. And then in cinematography, he's a shadow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's all about her.
Right. And she's front and central, particularly here in this painting from 1770. You know, women's sexuality is for the pleasure of male sexuality, as opposed to women's sexuality being for the pleasure of women. Other thoughts? So there's no 21st century representations of David and Bathsheba per se, but there is this. Those of you watching, listening on the podcast, is a picture of Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh. There is this. This is an article that came out in the Houston Chronicle in February of this year, which is an expose of 200 Southern Baptist ministers being involved in some form of sexual misconduct. And these are about half pictures of most of them. I don't think they fit all of them in here. And these are just the ones that have been convicted. This doesn't include instances that have settled outside of court. I live in Boston. The Roman Catholic Church has their own version of this. The Church of Christ, as Sarah mentioned last night, has a little bit more of a shadowier version of this. We are by no means exempt. And then, of course, President Trump, the presidency. Women let me do whatever they want to them. They let me grab them by the pussy. That kind of language and ownership and dominance and power and complete disregard for women's bodies. You know, when we think about consent, when we think about consent, we think about it from the perspective of sexual abuse, and also from the perspective of sex education. How do we want to inform healthy interactions for our teenagers? And how have you heard consent described to you, like defined to you? Someone give me a definition. It's kind of a buzzword, for sure, in the sex therapy world, and couples therapy world, and I think it's entering into other arenas as well. So, what definitions come to mind?
Permission is kind of
mm-hmm. Yep, permission. So an agreement. Both people are agreeing to do a particular thing. Yeah.
I guess I think of something kind of different. It's sort of an explanation by someone who was looking for an excuse, saying, well, you didn't stop this. You didn't, like there's some form, there's some specific behavior or word that is supposed to stop it, and yet that's very blurry.
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, from, you know, from the standpoint of abusers, that's very
so it's a complete so consent is not a complete disregard for boundaries. Consent is a process of, like, respecting boundaries, respecting kind of the what works, what doesn't work. And then what we see in the David and Bathsheba story, potentially anyway, and for sure in the three stories on the screen with Blasey Ford, Trump, and then the abuse scandal in the Southern Baptist Church, an abuse of these boundaries, boundary violations.
I think all of us have, well, I know all of us have experience with consent,
mm-hmm.
And taking it for a moment out of the sex realm. Anytime you go to the doctor,
mm-hmm.
you are giving
mm-hmm.
consent,
yep.
or the dentist. And so we all experience it in that way.
Right.
In the medical or therapy fields, it's informed consent.
Yep.
The idea that you know what's about to happen. And
right.
You say, that's fine. Whether or not you read it and actually are informed.
Yeah.
Whatever. And in my world, also as an LMFT and working with students here at Pepperdine for a number of years, this is something that we talked a lot about,
mm-hmm.
Educating all students about what consent is, and what you were mentioning is an idea of, like, passive consent, that it must have been okay because there was nothing one was doing to actively stop me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Versus an active consent of, you know, that idea roughly analogous to the doctor's office.
Sure.
I know what's happening here.
Right.
And I'm on board. We're on the same page.
Right. Right. There's an ethical principle in the world of therapy called informed consent. So as a client of mine, I am letting you know ahead of time some details about what the couples therapy process looks like. So I'm informing you. There's nothing in small print. It's all in the same Times New Roman 12-point font. You read through it. You agree to sign it. Couple problems with the idea of consent. One of the challenges is that we let legal advocates define consent and kind of be some of the leaders in defining what consent is, which I think is fine to a certain extent. But one of the problems is that consent then becomes kind of this litigious process. It becomes this he said, she said. And one of the challenges we saw this particularly in the Blasey Ford Kavanaugh stage is it becomes, well, whose story are you going to believe? Mm-hmm. As opposed to a recognition that there are years and years of, and centuries upon centuries of practices of privilege and power that eliminate conversations around consent. There's a very different process if someone is legally defining what consent is versus relationally defining what consent is. And we'll move into the relational definition of this in a minute. But let's talk about Canada. Canada does sex way better than the U.S. does. According to the Canadian government, a firm lack of an agreement suggests that there is no consent that is obtained. So if someone says no and you blow through that, that is a violation of consent. An agreement is not mutual. So two people are talking for some... an example of that would be two people are talking about something and then one person speaks for another person. Oh yeah, she's fine with that. Don't worry about it. The agreement is somewhat overt, but it's not a mutual agreement and kind of this passive agreement, Dave, that you were talking about. Someone is incapable of consent. Three things come to mind: sexual violence, youth. Obviously, I think that we will all agree that an 11-year-old is unable to consent to a sexual situation. And then I really like this language: an induction of activity through someone abusing their position of power, trust, or authority. So when we're talking about sex, we also have to think about power. And who has voice, and how do we give both people in a particular experience equal access to that voice, equal access to what happens. But one of the challenges with this definition is that it so often does what we do in the church, and even what we do in the sex therapy field. We define sexual practices based off of what it isn't, what sexual health isn't. And we aren't particularly good at talking about what sexual health actually is. And today, one of the things that I want to do is to give us a definition and some specific tools to think about how to incorporate consent into primarily our primary relationships, our long-term committed relationships. I love this definition. This is from the University of Michigan. University of Michigan is one of the best schools in the U.S. at addressing issues of sexuality. Their sexual assault prevention team is really, really good. They also have a high-quality sex therapy training program that I have some friends that have gone through. So I want to read this aloud for those listening to the podcast. Consent is a clear and unambiguous agreement expressed outwardly through mutually understandable words or actions to engage in a particular activity. So what I want to do for the next 40 minutes that we have is take some of these words and parse some of these out. That in this definition, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different eight different tools of consent just packed onto this little three-line definition that I want to go through and kind of talk about kind of item by item. And I'm curious about your feedback along the way. As we're doing this, please feel free to ask questions. Please feel free to make comments. I'd love to, this is definitely a collaborative conversation to have. So, as I mentioned, that in when we talk about consent, we talk about consent primarily through three arenas. One, through the sexual assault, sexual violence arena. Two arenas in it. One, through sexual assault, sexual violence arena. And then the second one, in terms of how we educate our teenagers, how we educate our college students. There's a growing movement, particularly in college campuses. ACU, actually, Abilene Christian, just hired someone recently to kind of oversee this, looking at sexuality, sexual misconduct, those types of things. And what I want to do today, the second theme, is I want to move conversations of consent from those arenas and into the world of our long-term relationships, into the world of our marriages, into the world of our partnerships, and think about how to incorporate tools of consent in improving our long-term relationships. So I want to start with the idea of an agreement, that consent is ultimately an ongoing conversation. It's a conversation between two people. And one of the reasons that, and we'll talk about this in a bit, one of the reasons that I think that this is challenging in longer-term relationships and in marriages is that, you know, the longer that you're together, the easier it is to rely on past experiences, on assumptions, on just kind of trusting that, oh, well, this is kind of the way that we've done it. So consent is an ongoing conversation where we're continually being intentional about talking these things out. It's a negotiation. It's a negotiation of needs. It's a negotiation of wants. There's giving and receiving. So not just what can I give in a situation, but also what can I receive. Just as a heads up, I probably should have done this at the beginning. I apologize for not doing this. There will be some sexually explicit material in this. Whoever is editing this, if they want to move that to the top. There will be some sexually explicit material through this conversation. I will be using sex and a sexual interaction kind of as a metaphor for how we might do this in other contexts. So in the context of sex, then, you know, what are some things that I would like to give to my partner in a sexual relationship, or that I'd like to do to my partner? What are some things that I'd like to receive? What are some things I'd like my partner to do to me? How do we talk about those types of things? And then when we're talking about these agreements, I encourage us, particularly with things inviting this much vulnerability, to really limit the amount of time that we have for conversations, particularly if talking overtly about sex is new to your relationship, maybe limiting the amount of time you talk about this to 10 minutes at a time. Game of Thrones fans, Matt, can you explain what's going on in this picture? So on the podcast, I have a picture of Jon Snow looking deeply into the eyes of Ygritte. Someone's going to have to email me and tell me the context about what this is. But when we think about, you know, one of the challenges that we have in the church is that we don't have very good models for how to talk about sex. The model that we have for talking about sex is, well, just don't do it until you get married. And then once you're married, you figure it out. So that leaves a whole bunch of holes. And one of the holes that's been filled has been Hollywood, has been TV. The pornographic industry, the sex work industry has been a part of this too. You know, we learn how romance works. We learn how sex works through these types of interactions. So I want to throw this up here, this idea of eroticism. So one of the reasons that scenes like this work is that eroticism, so like intense combination of sexuality and vulnerability, requires two things. It requires folks to be attracted to each other, and then it requires some level of obstacles. So God only knows what kind of war Jon Snow has just fought. I'm sure Egret was awesome in this as well. They're getting together. Oh, we're still alive. And we're kind of using this obstacle of like overcoming death to create this incredible amount of romantic tension.
To take that one step further.
Yep.
In the story, they're not supposed to be together. It's
right.
Romeo and Juliet. It's two different tribes or peoples, and they're breaking all sorts of obstacles.
Yep, and that creates that creates the eroticism.
Yeah.
And writers are really good at writing that into movies and into screenplays. It keeps us watching. We want to see people connect. We want to see people get together. The problem is when we make that our expectation. That this is how sexuality works. We just kind of fall into it. It just kind of happens. We see each other from across the room. We run into each other's arms. And we're significantly disappointed when our sex lives don't actually work like that. So one of the other things about consent is that this is not a romantic process. This is work. This is a conversation that will be really hard at times. It requires intentionality. It requires a level of depth that's very different from the way that sex and romance are shown on TV. Questions so far? Okay. So I want to go from the beginning of the definition. So these agreements are clear, first and foremost. One of the things that contributes to clarity is that we're only speaking for ourselves. We're not speaking for our partners. We're only speaking for our own needs. We're not speaking for what we think our partner wants. We're not for what our assumptions are. That's a bit of a shift for us in the church, I think. Because in the church, we're taught that by being relational, we're focusing on the other person. We're doing whatever the other person is can do to make them comfortable. We're taught not to be selfish. Selfish is a no-no. But in the world of in creating positive sexual experiences and positive relational experiences, we need to know what we want. We need to know what we need out of a particular experience. We want to know kind of what our images are, what we fantasize about, what we dream, what we hope. How do we tap into those types of things? And then the other thing is three questions that come after this. What are we going to say yes to? What are we going to say no to? And then what are we going to say maybe to in terms of receiving information from our partners? I'm aware that we're about 30 minutes in. I have worksheets, if you guys would like some. So I have these questions on these worksheets. These are for your eyes only. Please, if you want to share these with your partners, please do that. This is also really kind of personal information for us to share. And I'd like you to take a couple of minutes. I'd like you to take a couple minutes to jot down some notes about what are your needs. So what are the non-negotiables for how I want my body to be treated, for how I want to advocate for my body. What are my wants? What are some things that, hey, this would be really nice if this could happen? What do I dream about? Oh, in a perfect scenario, I would be able to kind of be in this type of scenario. And then on the back of it, for those of you on the podcast, are pictures of naked bodies. There's sketches. Don't freak out. And what I want to ask you to do with this is, on the bodies that you have, is to shade in the areas that you're okay receiving touch in any kind of situation. I am okay in any kind of situation having someone come up and put their hand on my shoulder. I'm totally good with that. I am never okay with someone slapping me on the butt. That's an absolute no-no in any kind of situation. in those situations where you're not comfortable receiving any kind of touch, if you'll mark X's through those parts of your body. There's a lot of gray areas. Some of this is situational. Maybe in a particular context, yeah, I'm okay having a foot massage. But you know what? If I've just gotten through working out and if I haven't taken a shower, no, stay away from my feet. Mm-hmm. So maybe take a minute or two to jot down some notes. And more importantly, kind of once this is over, take some time maybe to go through this on your own and then also with your partner hopefully in a private, in a set-apart conversation. This part of the podcast needs some really funky music.
Yeah.
Or like a saxophone playing.
Yeah.
Again, if you're listening on the podcast, feel free to take some notes about what are your needs, what are your wants, what are your fantasies, what are you willing to say yes to, what are you willing to say no to, and then what are you willing to say maybe. What's contextual? What are you willing to negotiate in certain situations? Maybe take another 20 or 30 seconds. One of the side projects that I do is that I run a nonprofit that just launched, a professional association, and I have a woman that I work with who is essentially my consultant, and she's introduced me to this acronym, W4H. Who, what, when, where, how. And when we're talking about consent, one of the other things that we want to think about is this is an unambiguous process. We want to be as clear as we possibly can. So we want to be clear with we want to be clear with what we want touched. We want to be clear with where. What do we want touching in a where situation? When do we want this happening? My assumption is that for most of us, if not all of us listening to the podcast, the who is going to be our partner, but who is an important question. And then a how. How do we want our bodies engaged with? How do we want to be touched? How do we want to be talked to while this is happening? What's the process behind this? And I think that getting as much objective information as we can is really, really helpful. I would also encourage you, as part of figuring this out, to explore your own body. Self-touch is an incredibly important thing. Masturbation is an important thing. This is how we learn what feels good for our bodies, so that we can then effectively communicate that to our partners. Hey, you know what? When I my whole left side of my body goes numb in a particular situation, just wanted to let you know about that. It feels really good. Can you do this in this particular context? One of the challenges with this, again, is that our churches haven't done a very good job at explaining what sexual health is. And in the couples that I work with, particularly those from religious backgrounds, they haven't been given opportunities to do this. I mean, how many of you have been given opportunities to kind of explore some of these questions? I'm getting some shakings of heads. So don't be afraid of couples therapy. Don't be afraid of sex therapy. It's not a taboo. It's a challenging process at times, but it's also incredibly rewarding. I also have two books on the screen. One is Paul Joannidis's Guide to Getting It On, which I think is probably the best introductory primer to sex. That's a big book. It's like 500 pages. But it's very encompassing. And then the book Emily Nagoski's Come As You Are is particularly good at talking about women's sexuality and encouraging women to advocate for sexual health, something that really has never been done in the context of it, at least modern history. So Nagoski's book is really, really transformative. I want to talk for a minute about what are things that prevent consent from happening before going on to the rest of the words that were highlighted on the screen. I mentioned that that in long-term relationships, consent can be hard because we fall into patterns. We fall into habits of interaction, and those habits of interaction are the things that keep our relationships going. They keep our families going. It creates security for us. It creates a sense of knownness for us. And one of the things that I commonly hear from my couples is this idea, oh, well, I just know that my partner's going to do this. Well, how do you know that your partner's going to do it? Well, I just know. I just do. That interaction is referring to some sort of unconscious recognition of the habits that we develop. And one of the problems with that is that all habits can be broken. If you assume, or if I assume that my partner is going to respond in a certain way and act out of that way, I don't give her the chance to change. I limit her ability to grow in that particular situation. I also prevent myself from growing, from being surprised, from potentially experiencing new experiences with my partner if I operate out of assumptions. So be mindful of the times that you think or say out loud, well, I just know that that's what you do. Because, no, you don't. It takes some time to be more curious when those thought processes come up. Second thing that comes to mind is shoulds. So expectations about what it is to be, what husbands should do, what wives should do. What are some of those expectations, actually? What are expectations about what husbands should do, what wives should do, and where did we learn these from? And as y'all are thinking, I can think of one that immediately comes to mind. Men are supposed to be dominant. Men are supposed to take charge of things. And in a sexual context, that means that men are supposed to initiate sex. Those are some of the shoulds that immediately come to mind around masculinity, at least for me. I'm curious about other folks.
Well, there's the old idea that women should submit.
Sure, yep. Right, that's a complementary idea. And the whole idea of complementarianism that, well, men should take this particular role, then women should take this particular role, is not an idea of working together. It's an idea of men saying, oh, well, I'm going to do this, and women not really being left with an option of doing anything but submitting if the relationship is to continue.
Say the question one more time.
What are some of the shoulds that we've learned about how to operate in a relationship as a man, how to operate in a relationship as a woman?
We're getting awfully personal in here. The idea that, like, we have to initiate an orgasm from the other partner.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That is.
Right.
And as a man, if you don't finish that or do that, then that your masculinity is hurt.
Right.
You're not Yeah, a successful partner.
The woman's orgasm is the man's responsibility.
Absolutely, yeah.
When in actuality, if we're talking about orgasm, which is probably a whole other hour worth of conversation, our own orgasm is our own responsibility. Men, your orgasm is your responsibility. Women, your orgasm is your responsibility. And right, and when we kind of operate out of what you just explained, that that creates anxiety.
Yeah.
That brings a lot of pressure into sexual situations for both partners. A lot of folks don't have a way of talking through that. Mm-hmm. And talking themselves out of that. I alluded to this earlier, but this idea of privilege, this idea of entitlement, things are owed to me, either because I'm a penis owner, because I'm a vagina owner at times. And I also put it in here for those on the podcast, the art of being right. One of the ways that conversations in general can get really shut down is when we get into arguments about, which is the right perspective? And there's a couples therapy adage that it's not about what's more important, being right or the relationship. Very often, this fight about whose voice is privileged, whose story is privileged, that gets in the way of having healthy interactions. The fourth thing, and I think that the church has been highly complicit in this, is that just the absence of information. You only know what you know at any given point. I began this journey towards sex therapy 3 or 4 years ago. And I would say that before that, and maybe even some along the way, that there were probably, just also in the name of being personal, there were probably some sexual experiences that were not consensual in the process. I didn't have the language, I didn't have the tools, I didn't have the emotional capacity to know kind of how to talk about this and how to process this with my partner. I don't know what I don't know at the time. And now that I kind of have some of this information, trying to use that to create different processes for doing relationship, including sexuality. This is Linda K. Klein. She's fantastic. She's a good friend. She recently published a book called Pure. I highly recommend reading this. I want to read. So Linda interviews several hundred women who grew up in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s in the purity culture, and talks with them about, draws out some different themes about how sexuality has been limited, and also how women work themselves out of that and work themselves into ways of developing their own relationships with their bodies. Sometimes in the context of the church, sometimes out of the context of the church. I want to read an excerpt from that, if that's okay. This is kind of long. Linda writes in her introduction, "When I was young, I thought God was in the hand that scooped me up when I joined the evangelical church. The hand cradled me, and I felt safe and protected. I believed that God lived here, in this one religious expression, with all of its interpretations, rules, and regulations, including those that felt wrong to me even then, like the purity ethic. But as I grew older, the hand began to squeeze me, and I became uncomfortable. I tried to make myself smaller, squishing myself down so I could fit inside of it, but all the ways in which I was not the right, quote-unquote, kind of Christian woman squeezed through between the hand's fingers, and I was exposed. I tried cutting parts of me off, the appendages that made it more difficult to fit, but I didn't have the guts to really cut them off. I just hid them under my clothing, like a character in a B-movie hiding an arm inside of a shirt and pretending the dangling sleeve means it isn't there. Finally, I decided I'd stretch out, make myself some room. Maybe, I thought, the hand will loosen a little in response. But instead, the hand tightened its grip. More and more of me came oozing out between its fingers until one day I came bulging out between its thumb and its pointer finger like a giant bubble, and with a plop, I dropped, fell from grace, and landed flat on my face. this is the experience a lot of us have, particularly a lot of us that grow up in this culture. Women, and I also argue men, Linda and I have talked about this, that men have some similarities with this as well, emotional experience of trying to find, trying to discover their authentic selves or sexual selves, and doing so under some of the context of church that continue to say, don't do this, or do this in very limited, very specific context. And then if you fall outside of that very limited, particular context, the guilt and the shame that comes with that. So this is some of the kind of intra-psychic stuff that's going on that makes these conversations about consent really, really challenging to do in adult relationships. So I highly recommend Pure Linda K. Klein. Let's get back to the definition here. Consent is a clear and unambiguous agreement expressed outwardly through mutually understandable words or actions. So let's talk about those last seven words. Consent is something that is expressed outwardly. It's good to kind of think through and maybe even to write out what you want, what you need, but at some point this needs to be a conversation between you and your partner. One of the things that I recommend is to schedule times to talk. Hey, you know what? I'm wondering if it's okay. This idea came to mind that I would really like to process through. I'm wondering if we could schedule some time after dinner tonight. Probably just need like 5 minutes. Finding some language like that to talk and doing it in a non-sexual situation. So doing it over a cup of tea in your living room, something like that. There's a term in sex therapy that we use called sexual script. Basically, sexual script means is a catch-all for how do we want sex to work? Who do we want to start it? How do we want it to finish? What do we want to do in between? Think about sex, and for that matter, parenting, finances. Think about it as a play. Person A does this. Person B does this. Person A responds in this way. Person B responds in this way. Make sure you get in the parenthetical references, the stage directions. Take some time to kind of work through that together. And feel free to write some things out. And again, this is a when you do this, anxiety will come up, particularly if you're not practiced at this. So give yourself plenty of breaks. This is an issue with me. Don't try to just like barrel through it. give yourself the opportunity to take some time out if you need to take some breaks away from the conversation. But do my hope is that when you take a time out, you also schedule some time to return to the conversation. Consent is mutually understandable. So two words here, mutually understandable. So mutually, how do we know that we've made an agreement? This is something that I ask my couples quite a bit and often ends up being its own session. But I'd encourage you to talk with your partners about how do we know that we've made an agreement about anything. The mutual part is really important and is also a nice... Paul gets here eventually too. In the New Testament, the value of pleasure is for both partners. Both partners getting something out of this. So making sure that we're in some sort of agreement that the experiences, the sexual experiences that we create, that both partners get something out of this, and that this isn't. And my hope is that you do this enough, and this moves away from sex being an obligation. And then it's something that both people can enjoy. Ask questions. Be curious. If you don't understand something about your partner's experience, ask them about it. Don't fill in the gaps. You mentioned the impact of your family and how your family kind of impacts us. I'm curious to learn a little bit more. So always ask questions in times where you don't understand. And thinking about also the... Because we have a lot of different stories about how sexuality works. Our stories based off of how we present as gendered people, as men, as women. as white people, as people of color, our families, the regions that we grew up in. There's a lot of potential material to tap into here, as a way of getting to know your partner and as a way of giving your partner and yourself spaces to share your story and to grow. Consent is a verbal process. Consent is a verbal process. So we're thinking about using words here. How do we verbally initiate sex? You know, not kind of this passive, oh, well, we're just kind of in bed and then we start kind of rolling around and, oh, I guess we're having sex. But how are we intentional about making sure that we're both on the same page, that sex is something that we're interested in and that sex is starting? One of the ways I think that pornography gets sex wrong is that nobody talks in a pornographic scene. There are a lot of noises being made, but nobody is really talking to each other. And I think that talking to each other throughout a sexual experience, hey, that feels really good. Hey, what do you need? Hey, is it okay if we do this? I think that that is really, really important, even as it's also a potentially stressful experience to be able to do. You may experience an enormous amount of vulnerability doing this. And we'll talk about some ways to kind of work through that vulnerability here in a minute. The words yes and no are also really important. Thinking about the variety of ways that we can say yes. Actually, yes, this is something that I would want to do. No, actually, I'm not interested in this particular thing right now. What are your options for saying no? And how can you say yes and no in ways that are respectful to the other person? And I would encourage you to take some time maybe to write out, hey, you know, honey, how would you like to hear no? When I say no, when is it most effective to you? And then when you receive the word no, if you're the recipient of the word no, how do you accept that word? Not have some sort of like emotional temper tantrum because it didn't get your way. But how do you... how do you accept that? When you say no, this is what you can expect from me. Kind of working out those types of agreements. Words and also actions. I had a supervisor in college tell me that sex is play therapy for adults. I really like that language. Sex is about play. How do we play together? What are ways that you flirt? Take a minute to think about that. What are some ways that you flirt with your partner, with your spouse? And then how do you develop meaning around that flirtatious activity? Be clear with each other about what physical activity leads to sex and what physical activity doesn't lead to sex. You know, when we start making out, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that sex is happening. Sometimes we're just making out, we're making out. And that's all that we really need in that situation. Hey, you know, when you touch me in a particular location, you know, I touch you back, that's our kind of physical agreement that we are kind of moving into something sexual. And having conversations about that. There's some folks that I work with who have the idea of a sexual menu. So identifying what's on and off the table. And that gives us back to the bodies that we have. What are activities that we enjoy to do together? What are activities that are hard no's? I'm good doing missionary style sex, but once we move into oral sex, you know what? I'm kind of uncomfortable with that. So can we leave it off the table for now? That might be a way of kind of working through that together. The book Guide to Getting It On is a really good resource for giving a lot of ideas for the breadth and depth of what can be on a sexual menu. I want to take a minute to talk about this idea of aftercare. So aftercare is after you agree the sexual experience is over, recognizing that it's not actually over. that there may be some stuff, particularly if we're intentional with each other, about talking through a sexual experience, about really like sharing ourselves during a sexual experience, stuff might come up for us. And it's really important to tend to the relationship after a sexual relationship, after a sexual experience is over. So how do we, how do we hold each other? What conversations do we have? How do we want the next 10 minutes, 15 minutes after a sexual experience is over to look, to really care for the relationship, to really tend to, parts of us that, that were potentially uncomfortable, potentially exhilarated. And it also gives you the chance to process. Hey, what worked for you? What do you want to do again? Hey, actually, let's not do that again. I'm glad that we experimented. I'm glad that we did that other way. But let's never go back to that again. It gives you the chance to kind of process together. One more look at the definition here. Consent is a clear and unambiguous agreement expressed outwardly through mutually understandable words or actions to engage in a particular activity. Those on the podcast, the phrase particular activity is bolded. And this is a recognition that each sexual experience may be different. One of the themes of folks that come in for sex therapy is that very often the ways that they do sex is it's the same way. It's on repeat. You know, you go through the same motion. You go through the same process of doing sex. And there are times when that may not work for a person. There are times that may work for both people, but how do you create enough openness, enough adaptiveness to ensure that each experience might be different? I put the question up here, as you practice this more, as you practice incorporating consent and some of the principles that we're talking about into your relationships more, there may be times when you agree that, hey, it's okay for sex just to happen. You know, we're agreeing to set apart a specific time each week. Whatever happens, happens. But we're committing to spending that time intimately together. And then when are also times that sex requires more intentionality? I was going to give an example, but I'll keep going. And then I wanted to end here that I think that this can be really important, not just for sex, but for a lot of different facets of our life. There's a therapy term called parallel process. That means that if one thing is happening in one situation, it often happens in other types of situations as well. So the way that we talk about sex, then, is also the way that we talk about and practice parenting. It's also the way that we practice and talk about finances. It's also the way that we talk about a division of labor and how those decisions get made. These principles that we're talking about can also be applied to each of the categories that I listed: parenting, finances, division of labor, other administrative types of tasks. So, questions and comments. I've got probably 5 minutes or so for any kinds of comments. Let me check in with you all, actually. Let me do some aftercare with you all. Because I know I threw a bunch of information at you. This is probably a 2-hour workshop condensed into one. What information stuck with you?
I can't help but think about just the amount of conversation that you described.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been married for 60 years.
Uh-huh.
And this would have been really good to know 60 years ago.
Yeah.
With much conversation. So I think, it's really amazing to me all the progress, I guess you'd call it,
yeah,
and being intentional and, really being aware of
yeah,
so much of this.
Yeah,
you're doing good work.
Thank you. And again, just want to reiterate if for others that have had that experience in here, you do the best that you can with the knowledge
that
you have.
Oh, yeah. It's worked for 60 years.
So, right. Other things that came up for folks? That's not the right question. What information landed on you in a particularly meaningful way?
Well,
the whole idea that all of it has to be intentional.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it needs to be intentional.
You have to know what you want, and you have to be able to communicate it. And there's so much, so many assumptions made about, well, you did this, that was, you know, I mean, there's
right.
so much of that.
Right.
And in a relationship that's maybe even been going on for many, many years, that,
sure.
yeah, if you're not intentional, Randy Carlson will be pro. Intentional life.
Yeah. Well, I think in the church that so much of our identity as to who we are is shaped around our gender. Men do this, women do this. And I think that those assumptions are, A, limiting to the full capacity of what masculinity and femininity means, and also shuts down conversations and kind of prevents that level of intentionality. So,
thinking we know our partner.
Uh-huh.
That's resonating.
Yeah.
We think we know what he's, you know, I think I know what he's thinking, what he's going to do.
Right.
Or wants.
Right.
Because we don't talk about it.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to assume.
Yeah. Right, which is an evolutionary process. It's a way that we survive and kind of get through things.
It's
evolutionary biology often runs in the face of relational health. Because relational health requires us to do things that run antithetical to what our bodies naturally want to do. Which is make the assumptions, not have the conversations, keep peace.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's scary to think about doing the vulnerability involved. I mean, I've read Brené Brown's book, and and that's a really scary place. And if you've been doing the same thing for 20 years, and now you want to open that little bit up, and
right.
you're in your 60s, and you're going, just leave it be.
So,
some of the things you're saying, my mind's taking me down a lot of paths of where that could go.
Yeah.
And maybe that's not a good thing. Don't think too hard.
Well, but exactly. And my hope is that's exciting, but I'm curious if that's also, as you said, a little bit terrifying.
It is. But it's exciting.
Sure.
You know, because, there may be some resentment or needs unmet, but
right.
you really want to tear into this one.
Right.
So that's interesting.
Or there's also, do you really want to continue a status quo?
Yeah, the same. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
also scary.
No, it
sure.
is. But it's known.
Yeah.
So.
Well, as you're saying, institutions are built around the maintenance of the status quo. That's as large as the church. That is as small as your couple relationship. I guess that's kind of what I mean by the evolutionary biological perspective of how does this relationship survive? Surviving and thriving are two different things.
It's true.
So, and this is, I see this daily in my work with my couples and also doing this in my own relationship as well.
Right.
And
there's just this sound in my head saying, is it really safe to do this at this age and at this long into it? You know, this
sure.
weird conversation my head's having right now.
Sure,
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious how many others in the room and on the podcast are having that thought too.
And when you say podcast, what are you talking about?
So this is being recorded.
Right.
And this is going to be on the Pepperdine podcast.
Okay, so
for
it's where this is
PBL.
Recorded. Okay, it's not
it's
another
PBL,
podcast.
The Harvard
partnerships.
Okay. So, did I get that right? I don't want to give bad information. Anything else? I'd love to continue conversations with you. I have business cards. Here's my contact info. That's the website of my company, sssshealthcenter.com. My email address, jeremiahgibsonlmft@gmail.com. And then my number is 617-657-9793. And I have business cards if you guys would like to.